for those of us who already identify with being a Buddhist, our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. And the second line, the two lines, are expressing this motivation. And this prayer, I don't know what page it is. Same page, okay. Sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chonyen gipa sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la jang cho badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chonyen gipa sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la Jangcho badu dagni kyabsu chi dagi chonyen gipa sonam ki drola penche sangye drupa shok. So the topic is actually advanced teachings. This topic is advanced teachings. And the compassion wing, see, what, as we must know if we've heard any of the Tibetan Buddhist teachings in the past, particularly Gelugpa, we know that Tsongkhapa has packaged all the teachings from A to Z in a very coherent, orderly way, you know. So like any body of knowledge, we know very well, you start at the simple stuff, you go to the middle stuff, and then you go to the most advanced stuff, and then you graduate. This is what we really understand with all bodies of knowledge. But I think we don't get this when it comes to spiritual teachings. We don't think that way, you know. But this is very especially the way of Tibetans have packaged the Buddha's teachings. And this Lam Rim is exactly that. So, of course, these words, you know, we don't say, when you do music or mathematics, you don't say you're studying a gradual path of music. It sounds ridiculous. But that's this 14th century term, probably perhaps coined even earlier than before Atisha, a gradual path. But if we say it's a course, straight away we get it. Oh, a course. We're doing a course. Well, we know some courses take a year, some take 20 years, you know. Well, this one takes several lifetimes. But still, it's a course. And you begin at the beginning stuff, and you go to the middle, you go to the advanced, and then you graduate. And what do you graduate as? A Buddha. So even hearing the meaning of the word Buddha is so powerful, it tells us the entire path. It indicates exactly the methodology, you know. The etymology of the word in Sanskrit, Buddha, and the Tibetan equivalent, Sangye, is very tasty. So Sang, or Bud, implies the total eradication from our own mind of all ego, all fears, all neuroses, all depression, anger, attachment, jealousy, all the stuff we are intimately familiar with and which we know is horrible. And the Buddha has found, from his own direct experience, that this stuff is not at the core of our being. This is kind of outrageous. If we think of this psychologically, and that's how Buddha's talking, don't hear it as mystical, to hear that this is our potential, there's no equivalent of that in our modern psychology, in our neuroscience. It's like a crazy idea. It's really radical. But this is already the first point. Not only that, da, gay, what that implies is that we can develop to perfection all the other stuff in our mind. Compassion, wisdom, kindness, all this stuff. We know this stuff too. This is the stuff of Buddhism. And this word, Buddha, the etymology, implies, tells us exactly the job. So in terms of this packaging of the Lam Rim, as Lama Zopa very politely, you know, he respects the lineage, so he very politely refers to the first stages of practice, you know, as the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the least capability. Well, that's a mouthful. Well, what would we call it if we were studying a course? In English, in Australia, I'd call it going to junior school. So whatever you Italians call it, as soon as you hear that, you get the meaning. The implication is clear. You start at the easy stuff. That's exactly this first lot. They often refer to as the lowest scope of teachings. Then, of course, the middle scope, high school, why not, is the teachings and practices suitable to the disciples of the middle capability. Now, that's the wisdom wing. That's all the nuts and bolts of Buddha's teachings about karma and the mind, how it works, Buddhist psychology, which is very extensive. This is all the nuts and bolts of what a person who is wanting to work on their mind using Buddhism to help develop their own amazing potential. That's the wisdom wing. That's the stuff of what Buddhism is. And it's this that then qualifies us to go to the next stage, the compassion wing, the teachings and practices suitable to the disciple of the greatest capability, well, why not call that university? It's immediate. The taste of it is so clear. We get this, you know. In other words, all the teachings in Buddhism are gradual. They're steady. You know, and in English, we say, in fact, grade one, grade two, grade three, and then you graduate. So this word gradual has great, in English, it's very clear, you know. But like I said, we're not used to thinking spiritual teachings like this. But it's really important to get this. Then when we hear the entire path, it's not just one big lump of spiritual teachings, which is how we hear it, but it's very gradual, very incremental. And then when you learn to practice it, you get to know what level you're at. So the essence of junior school is abiding by the laws of karma. It's practicing good ethics. Don't harm sentient beings. The essence of junior high school is work on your mind. That's when you become a Buddhist. You learn the nuts and bolts of the way the mind works, which is Buddha's expertise. That's when you really get to the root of the problems. And then then the compassion wing, that's university. That the essence of that is to help others. And then you've got postgraduate, Vajrayana, Tantra. So at any given moment in one day, if you're learning this path, if you decide to be kind to somebody, that's practicing university. That sounds surprising to us because that sounds so simple. But it's actually the compassion wing depends upon success at the wisdom wing. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. So here we're discussing this approach called transforming problems into happiness. We know it's a whole genre of practices, coming from in the Vajrayana, in the Mahayana teachings on the Bodhisattva path in the compassion wing, and it's really stressed hugely in Tibet. Well, that's the most radical level of the compassion wing. That's the most radical. So, in order to understand how to do that level, we have to understand junior school and high school first. It's impossible otherwise. And when we understand this, it's very sobering, and we will know ourselves where we are at and what we can do in any given day, It's really crucial to understand this, that the teachings are incremental, gradual, one step at a time. We have to know our level, have to know our capability. Otherwise, it's just too confusing. Because the teachings in this, in these texts we're going to talk about, they're kind of outrageous. I joke, but I don't joke. This eight verses, this one particular text that we're going to be going through, the eight verses by this Tibetan yogi Lungri Tangpa, seemingly simple words. The advice in these is really quite shocking because it's his most advanced level. And I joke, but I don't joke. But, if you're a therapist in our culture and you give some of the advice that they give in this text to one of your patients, you could be sued, I promise. It's so shocking. But when we read these, we get all kind of holy, Oh, yes, may all sentient beings be happy. May I take upon myself all their suffering, blah, blah, blah. If we haven't even begun to understand suffering in junior school and what causes it in junior school, and then begin to understand what even causes what we do with our body and speech, which is what goes on in our mind, which is high school, if we can't understand this, it is not possible to practice compassion at the level that Buddha's describing. It's really important to understand this. Okay, the word compassion, what's it mean? What's the definition? Well, it starts with a thought, and the thought would be, may you not suffer. You see a person suffering, and you empathize with it, and you wish they didn't suffer. That's the meaning of compassion. So, of course, we want to grow that to an infinite degree. And then what's love? Often these are referred to as the two main positive states of mind, like summarize all the other positive states of mind. So love starts with a thought. May you be happy. If you see someone happy, you're happy for them. You want someone to be happy. Love and compassion. These are fundamental. These are the essence of all the positive qualities that we can develop to perfection. But if we think, suffering, I see someone suffering, that means we have to define what is suffering. And this you have to learn back in high school. Junior school and high school is where we learn that. And if we don't understand this, then the compassion we have now in our culture is very limited compassion, and it's mostly based on, it's mostly sentimental and very limited for very few beings. But the Buddha's deal, the Buddha's point, is that we can have this incredible love and compassion for every single sentient being. The words sound nice. It sounds very kind of wow, you know. But we've got to understand the logic of it. We've got to understand how you get that. It's very technical. It's very powerful and necessary to understand this. And that's why we have to have junior school and high school first. That's the wisdom wing. Because if I want to have compassion for someone who is suffering, I need to know what suffering is. So we go to where we learn that is in what they call the Four Noble Truths. I think the truths aren't noble, actually. It's just how they call it. I think more correctly, it's probably the four truths for the noble ones. The noble ones being those who've realized the truth of these things, you know, who actually have the realizations. So these four truths, or I like to use the word facts, actually. Truth sounds a bit like religious, you know. The four facts for the noble ones. Well, these facts are referring to suffering. First one is that there is suffering. The second is there are causes. The third is you can get rid of the suffering and its causes, and that's pretty shocking if you hear it. And the fourth is how to do it. This is the first teaching the Buddha gave, you know. So the words suffering and the words happiness, they're very simple, but these are very powerful for Buddhism. You know, there's various doorways into Buddhism and how to understand it and how to practice it, but they all come to the same thing. So for sure, you can say that Buddhism is a method for how to stop suffering and get happiness. You can definitely say that Buddhism is a system of ethics, detailed explanation, you know, of ethics and how to live an ethical life. You absolutely can say that Buddhism is the method for stopping ignorance and getting wisdom. And you can also say Buddhism is very extensive psychology. It's a system of understanding the mind. And this is the biggest surprise, I think, to us, because we're so used to thinking that spiritual people talk about a thing called a soul or a spirit. Well, Buddha has no such concept. He talks about a mind. The mind is Buddha's expertise. And this is at the heart of all of Buddhism. For sure, Buddhism is a detailed philosophical presentation of the entire workings of the universe. But all of these come together. All of these come together. So I think in our culture, we understand wisdom. We think of very intelligent people, brilliant artists, genius scientists. And that's called wisdom. We get that. We have great methods for achieving that. But I think we never see it in relation to ethics, or we never see it in relation to happiness. So you can have a person who's a genius mathematician who's completely neurotic and miserable and goes home and beats up her husband every day. Because we don't think it, you know, wisdom is one thing, happiness is another, and ethics is a third thing. For Buddhism, these are all integrated. They all come to the same thing. You cannot possibly have good ethics without getting wisdom, without getting happy, without stopping suffering, without understanding the mind. They all come together. They're very integrated. It's very interesting. So the Four Noble Truths clearly is talking about presenting it in terms of the happiness and suffering model. Now, this is something we all know. We might not think we want wisdom. We're not sure we want wisdom. We're not sure we want to understand even the mind. We're not sure if we want a philosophical view of the universe. We all know we want happiness and don't want suffering. That's really clear, you know. So then if I want others to stop suffering, if I want others to be happy, which is the final point of this path, the compassion wing, then I absolutely have to understand it for myself first, and that's the wisdom wing. It's impossible otherwise. That's what we learn about it, and that's what we learn about the Four Noble Truths. So what is suffering? I mean, if we, you know, the third point the Buddha makes is we can get rid of suffering and its causes, then we need to know what it is, because that sounds pretty incredible. But even before we go into this, it's always important to, I always think it's so important to think about what the Buddha is and where this came from. Where did this information come from? This is a major point, that when we get this clear, then it informs how we listen to Buddhism and how we therefore practice it. And even though we know, if we, you know, as Buddhists, let's say, those of us who've committed to becoming Buddhists, we know that, oh yeah, Buddha doesn't talk about a creator. Oh yes, Buddha's not a creator. But we really got to understand the experiential implications of that. It's really quite powerful, and we've really got to think it through. Let's just look at that tonight before we even go into the details of what Buddha says. So I always, you know, I quote this particular one question someone asked years ago when I was teaching in New Zealand. And I noticed we all ask the same questions around the planet, I tell you. But this is the only time I've ever had this question. One person. And it happened to be a scientist in New Zealand, in Nelson in New Zealand. And he said, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? Which is a perfect question if you have the usual view of a religion, which is creator. I was a Catholic, very devoted. I was in love with God, Our Lady, the saints. I went to Mass. I wanted to be a nun when I was a little girl. Actually, I wanted to be a priest first when I was about three. Of course, they all laughed at me. I think I must have been so young intellectually, I didn't comprehend what they meant because I wasn't a boy, right? I just knew the priest was my job. Not the altar boy, the priest. I like being the boss, you know. So they told me I had to be a nun. So then I decided I'd be a nun. And then I was 12 on my knees begging my mother to let me be a nun like Saint Therese of Lisieux. She was my great hero. So anyway, so I was a Catholic and so naturally God is the boss because God is the creator. God is this energy, this source of the universe, the source of me, the source of all the rules. And naturally should be obeyed. That's a very fairly typical view that we have, you know. God is the boss. So therefore God, you know, the information comes from God. It's revelation. This is completely reasonable. If you posit that view, well, Buddha doesn't have that view. He's not a creator. He doesn't posit a creator. We don't need a creator. It's an unnecessary embellishment, he says. We've made up the creator part, he says. So this scientist, when I said to him, well, would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? Of course not. You'd be shocked, wouldn't you? You'd laugh and you'd be shocked. And we would be. Right now we think, what a silly idea. Because why? Very simple. Because we know Einstein was this clever fellow who used his own intelligence, his own powers of observation. And this is the point. He didn't make up anything. He observed what he saw. He observed the world. He observed the contents of the world, the various conditions of this planet, and he came up with these findings about how they functioned, and he presented his findings. So we know very well he didn't have a dream about it. He didn't have a vision. It wasn't revelation. He didn't make it up. He's not speculating. He's done his homework. And when he's confident he's right, he presents it to us. He does not ask us to believe him. All of those things is how we think of religion, you know, because we assume it's from on high, we assume it can't be proved, and we assume we can't know it. This is a really important point. And I said, well, Buddha's exactly the same, and I'm not joking. This is exactly what the Buddha is. He's this regular guy who used his own intelligence, his own powers of observation. Clearly, the Buddhist view of the level of our powers of observation are way more powerful than we think in the modern world about the mind. We'll go into this. The Buddhist view of the mind is way more radical, way more subtle, way more powerful, way more capable. We'll go into this later. So from his own observation, he has observed the universe, he observed the minds of sentient beings, he's observed behavior. And he's presented his findings. So Buddhism, if it's valid, and you should be careful because there's loads of rubbish published, because people think of it as religion, and somebody goes to a weekend retreat and has some kind of vision, then they write a book about it because they think it doesn't matter, which is so arrogant. So if the Buddhism is valid, you should check up this place, the books you read, that it's coming from a valid source, tracking back through the lineages right back to the Buddha. If what is Buddhism is valid Buddhism, then every word of it is coming from the direct experience of a person called Buddha and anyone else since then who has also become a Buddha. Because Buddha's fundamental point is we can all become a Buddha. It's the result, it's the natural potential of all of our minds. So the internet, even if you read a cookbook, it's so simple. You read a cookbook and you check your sources and you check this person, she's a valid author. Well, you know perfectly well she didn't steal, we hope she didn't steal the recipes. She's coming from her own direct experience. And if she's not, she will tell you, and she'll honour her mother whose recipes they are. In other words, the information in a cookbook, the information in the music theory, the music classes, is coming from human experience. Not from on high. Okay, in Buddhism, of course, some of the great yogis, The Arya Bodhisattvas can have direct revelation directly from the Buddha in the subtlety of their own meditation. That's another discussion. But the general point I'm making, every word in Buddhism is coming from the observation, the experience of people, not from on high, and therefore not merely a belief. That's just intellectual laziness in Buddhism. It's just superstition. And this is a major point because that's how we think of religion, as being not able to be proved, therefore can only be believed. And therefore we think, oh, I can believe what I like. It's just unbelievable. It's so shocking. It's so arrogant and lazy, intellectually lazy. Buddha's dealing with reality. You don't have to like what he says. He's not asking you to believe him, nor is Einstein. Einstein says, here's my findings. Now it's over to you to prove it for yourself. That's the same here. That's why to merely believe something is just absurd. You know, to believe in mathematics. Oh, I believe in mathematics. What a joke. How stupid. It works because many people know it. But if your mother goes and asks you to buy 5 oranges, but you don't know how to count, what good is believing in mathematics? None whatsoever. You have to internalize the information. That's the point in Buddhism. Believing in it is a good start. It energizes you to keep going. Having confidence in the teachings, having confidence in what Einstein says, that's important. But in the end, you have to internalize it and you prove it for yourself. Or, as the Dalai Lama points out to us foreign people, if you get to a certain point, having practiced Buddha's methodology step by step, and you prove that he's wrong from your own direct experience, then of course you must reject the Buddha. So understanding this really then gives the implication of how to approach being a Buddhist. It's very powerful. Not just to merely believe or to even... See, one of our problems in our culture too is many of us hear Buddhism for the first time and we really like it. Nothing wrong. The Buddhist view would be we've done it before. That's why we're attracted to it. But some, you know, I remember reading this 19-year-old white supremacist in America who said, when I first read Hitler, oh, wow, I found like I'd come home. Everything he said was so true. He felt the same as when we read the Dalai Lama. So just liking something is not enough. That's a good start. But we confuse liking Buddhism with knowing Buddhism. And that's why His Holiness the Dalai Lama is always telling us we should study. It's not enough to like it. You know, we just rest on our laurels. We have to internalize it and experience the validity of it, the truth of it. That's our job, you know. That's the way to take, that's the way to use these teachings. So, of course, because we can't prove much of this first, just like you can't prove a relativity when you're only in junior school, but you take it as your working hypothesis, and that's the approach too. I never say I believe in Buddhism. I mean, I never, because it's just, it's misleading to ourselves and others. And I'm not trying to sound wordy, but it's really accurate to say it's our working hypothesis. Working hypothesis. You have to eventually make it your direct experience, you know. So all the teachings you're hearing from this, in this room, from my mouth, are coming from the teachings I've received from Lama Zobo Rinpoche, Lama Yeshe, my lamas, many of the lamas that you know also, His Holiness, all of our, these teachers, they're my, this is my source. And they can track back, and we can track these back, right back to the Buddha, you know. If I make mistakes, and I'm misleading you, that's really shocking. So I hope I don't make mistakes. I hope Ciliana points out my mistake. Thank you. Okay. So what is suffering, and what are its causes? Because if we want to help other people, if we want to transform our problems into happiness, if we want to develop compassion, we've got to know this first. So the first one, there is suffering. 3 levels. Different ways of presenting, but one really practical approach is the 3 levels of suffering. The first one, Buddha would say, it's called the suffering of pain or the suffering of suffering. And that's the one we all agree with. That's the only one we agree with. That's the only one we even know. The world knows this one, the monkeys and the dogs and the ants and the humans. And this is simply when the bad things happen. Okay, it's pretty straightforward. The next level of suffering is extremely depressing because it's what we refer to as happiness. But for the Buddha, it's a more subtle level of suffering. He calls it the suffering of change. And we'll go into this. The third one is really abstract for us. All-pervasive suffering. And we'll go into this as well. So there's levels of suffering, therefore levels of causes, and therefore levels of practice to remove the suffering and its causes, you know. So one way of looking at all of this is in the bigger picture point of view. The bigger picture point of view for the Buddha is where we talk about karma. This is junior school. This is the nuts and bolts of Buddha's view of how the universe exists, how it functions, what is happiness, what is suffering, why this, why that, why dogs, why ants. It's Buddha's philosophical view, his presentation from his own direct experience about the way the universe is. It's the big picture point of view. So one big picture point of view that Buddha has is not fitting with our view at all, the materialist view, not at all. So he has a view about sentient beings. The word in Tibetan is very tasty for a sentient being. It's semchen, mind possessor. And as far as the Buddha is concerned, there are trillions upon trillions of mind possessors. Humans are a miniature percentage. Animals and bugs are another category of mind possessors. And then there are a whole range of other mind possessors that we cannot cognize with our mind at this level we function now. We can't cognize through our senses. Trillions of other sentient beings, the vast majority. There's a whole levels of realms of existence Buddha would refer to. And keep remembering, these are coming from Buddha's experience. He's not asking you to believe him. He's presenting his findings. You know, it's up to us to think about it. So happiness and suffering then can be presented in terms of these realms of existence, in terms of a type of rebirth. So all beings in the universe we can divide into two categories, Buddhas, fully enlightened beings, and everybody else. Then everybody else can be divided into samsaric beings and superior beings. Anybody who's a superior being is one who's realized emptiness. And then everybody else is in all these other realms of existence. And the one category of these is three realms of existence. And this is coming from these Hindus. This is something, too, to really remember. I always point out these days. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I remember reading a few years ago or hearing him say, it was these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago who were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self. We probably thought it was Freud 100 years ago. Well, we're mistaken. Okay, these genius Indians, unbelievable. Buddha came out of that incredible, brilliant tradition of yogis and scholars and thinkers and philosophers, and then he eventually diverged in his own direction, in particular in relation to his own direct experiential findings about the nature of self. So these Hindus found this too, and this is also from the Buddhist perspective, these three realms of existence among all the ordinary beings, all of those who are not out of samsara yet. There's the beings who are, won't go into much detail here. There's just a couple of other realms, beings who are in subtle meditation, subtle absorption of concentration. We'll discuss this later. Then the one that we're in, the grouping that we're in is called the desire realm. And there's really six suburbs in this desire realm. And from the spectrum of blissful happiness to the most horrible suffering. So happiness and suffering actually are very powerful concepts in Buddhism. Like I said, a whole way of presenting the entire path. As Dalai Lama says, as the Buddha says, every being wants just naturally to be happy and doesn't want suffering. This plays a very powerful role, this concept of happiness and suffering, in all the Buddha's path, from all the different perspectives, from the perspective of wisdom, of ethics, of psychology, and of philosophy. All comes down, one way of presenting is in terms of happiness and suffering. So there's six realms of existence. There are some rebirths that are the result of virtue and they are therefore have some level of happiness. There are some rebirths that are the result of non-virtue and have intense levels of suffering. So one way of describing the spectrum of suffering and happiness is in terms of these realms. So the suffering of suffering, this first kind of suffering, is referring to the three lower realms, as they call it. Then the second level of suffering, which we call happiness, it's also referring to the rebirths that are relatively happy, including the human. That's one way of presenting the bigger picture. But another easier way that we understand completely, is in terms of this life. We can understand these three levels, or at least the first two levels of suffering, in terms of this life. So let's stick to that one. It's easier for us to comprehend and to experience and to recognize. So the suffering of suffering is when the bad things happen. We get that. And that can be the mildest experiences of a slight headache to the most intense suffering of torture and pain. We get that. There's a spectrum, you know. Unbelievable suffering when the bad things happen. Then you've got happiness, which is when the good things happen. So as far as we're concerned, we either want, we don't want the ugly stuff and we do want the nice stuff. And reality is we spend our lives trying to avoid the suffering and trying to get the happiness. That's it. That's it. Every sentient being does the same. Every monkey, every ant is driven every second to try and find happiness and to stop suffering. And all Buddha's saying is, hey guys, I've found a method. He's criticizing our method, which he calls the samsaric method, and says we've got it wrong. Not moralistically, but practically. He says we're using the wrong methods. The methods that we think will work to get happiness and stop suffering are in fact methods that will increase our suffering. So this is why this is really quite technical. To understand this, not in a moralistic religious sense, but to understand it technically is really powerful. And then when we get this for ourselves, it is easy to have compassion for all sentient beings. So the suffering of suffering is when the bad things happen. The suffering of change, the second one, it sounds kind of boring, is actually when what we call happiness. So this is quite shocking that what we refer to as happiness, which is what getting the nice things, is what he refers to as a subtler, deeper level of suffering, even worse suffering. So we better understand it. We need to understand it. So right now, as far as compassion is concerned, if we look at the world, we do have compassion, there is no doubt. But we only have it for the first group. We only have it for when people who have bad experiences. We only have compassion for the dog if they're being hurt. We only have compassion for the children if they're being harmed. We only have compassion for anybody if they're poor or being harmed or abused or, you know, whatever. That's it. And usually, also, we only have compassion for innocent victims. So our view of compassion right now is profoundly limited. And it's because, without analysis, it's based on a certain series of assumptions, you know, about what suffering is and what are the causes. So in general, in our world and in our own view, intuitively, instinctively, when we see someone suffering, the next step is to find who caused it. Who caused it? Because we always assume someone did it to them. And then that brings anger. You know, and that Buddha would really find fault with that analysis. It's not wrong, it's not inaccurate to say that if you say some man kick a dog, the guy did kick the dog, that's not wrong. But our analysis of it, he says, is too small, way too short, way too limited. So if we look at the second noble truth, the causes of suffering, this is really powerful. This gets us to understand the nuts and bolts of Buddhist view of the universe. Why things happen, of why things happen. And this is his view. And this is two things. It's two things precisely. Two main causes of suffering. There are also two main causes of happiness. But here, you know, we're discussing suffering. So there are two main causes. But as far as we are concerned, whether it's ourselves or the guy kicking the dog, there's one cause of suffering and it's the guy kicking the dog. There's one cause of my suffering and it's the mean boyfriend. That's it. That's our analysis. Instinctively, primordially, we grasp at that view and we don't question. And if you look at the world, that's the view, that's the philosophy of the world. We look for something or a person or an event out there, and that is the main cause. This is so clear, and it's absolute in us. We don't question this analysis at all. And this is where the Buddhist view comes in, because it's radically different. It's radically different analysis. So before we begin to understand this first, so the two main causes of suffering are stated in the second noble truth. They're simply, you know, the terms are karma and delusions. Karma and, I don't know, this term delusions in Italian. Have we discussed this before? What's the word you use for delusions? Huh? I know. I hate that word. Lama never used it. Let's discuss this. If we don't get, this is really powerful. Lama never used affliction. He used like 21 different synonyms in Mahamudra. I identified 21. Because this is a very fascinating one. This is the main word you use in Italian, is it?
Yeah, because delusion.
I know, the same in Spanish, same in French. Yeah. I know it's the same. It's very fascinating. We've got to discuss this. Meaning, I understand. I understand. I understand. I hear you. So let's discuss this because this is incredibly important. Okay. So there are two main causes of suffering in the Four Noble Truths. Okay. Karma and we'll use another word then. We'll say the word affliction for the moment and let's describe it. Because we've got to understand the meaning of this. Affliction is the word they use in English too, and that's the main word they use in Tibetan, coming from klesha in Sanskrit. And it's a fine word. But I think because it's not a mod, we don't use it in our daily life, do we? You don't say, oh, I have an affliction. It's very medieval, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't even say it. So let's analyze the meaning of this word, because if we don't get this, we don't understand Buddhism. We don't understand Buddhist psychology, that's for sure. So first of all, okay. Karma is like what we learn about in junior school. We're going to get to that. We're going to go to high school for a second and look at the mind. Karma is dealt with in junior school, the essence, the fundamentals, and when we get to high school, the middle scope, we then start to look into the way the mind functions. And Buddha's got a very distinct model, a very clear way of describing the mind, and very specific to Buddhism. We often don't get this, you know, but it's so necessary to understand this. We really want to understand to be a Buddhist and therefore want to practice. Like I said, the Buddha's view in our mental consciousness, all our thoughts and feelings and emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, this entire spectrum of our inner being. This is called our mental consciousness. We know we have the sensory consciousness, but this is, even the way we give power to our sensory consciousness is so inappropriate. For the Buddha, it's really misleading. And as Lama Yeshe says, we make the body the boss. It's so inappropriate. And we'll go into this later. But let's look at the contents of our mind. Tibetans often point here. And as Lama Zopa said, this is where the workshop is. This is what we have to become intimately familiar with if we're serious in being a Buddhist and if we want to stop suffering and get happy and, therefore, if we want to help others. This is crucial. So, the Buddha divides all the contents of this mind of ours, and we know there are thousands of thoughts a day. In here, it just feels like utter chaos, doesn't it? And this is normal for us. And we have what we call unconscious, subconscious, all these weird things that come in dreams, and we have no idea about most of this, no idea where it all comes from, no idea why we feel all these crazy things. This is our mental consciousness. So for the Buddha, he divides all of this into three categories. There are those states of mind that are neurotic, ridiculous, disturbing, fear-based, distorted. Afflictions is the word they use when I'm going to talk about this. They're the source of our pain. They are not at the core of our being, and they can be removed. This is the entire point of the entire path all the way to Buddha. So if we understand that what Buddha means is get rid of all the rubbish from our mind and grow all the goodness, then we've got to know how to identify these. And this is so specific to Buddhism. So, okay, you know, the Buddha talks about this vast map of the mind. And this came from these Indians before the Buddha. These ingenious, brilliant Indians who are the ones who created this incredible psychological skill called single-pointed concentration, shamatha, okay? These Indians, well before the Buddha. They created this brilliant, ingenious psychological skill that enables you with incredible effort and discipline and time to go beyond, to subdue the grosser level of our consciousness, which is sensory and conceptual, to go to a subtler level of our mind, a much more subtle, more powerful, more focused level of our capacity for cognition, which is what the mind is. And we don't even posit such a level of mind in our modern world or in neuroscience. A subtler level of mind that's brilliant, that's clear, focused, and incredibly powerful. And in the long term, to accomplish what Buddha says we can, we have to get that shamatha. We have to get that single-pointed concentration. We'll discuss all this later. In Lama Yeshe's book, Mahamudra, there's lovely teachings about this. So these Indians created this technique, these ingenious, brilliant Indians. And what they did was they mapped the mind. And so the Buddha now, he didn't chuck out what he learned from these Indians. He went on in his own direction, particularly, as I said, in relation to his own findings about the nature of self, but also in his own presentation of karma, the way the mind works, so many ways. And this is what's been studied in this great monastic university system since, 2,000 years ago in India and in Tibet, the last 1,200 years, So the Buddha describes all this first category of all these ridiculous neurotic states of mind, invalid misconceptions, wrong views, emotional dramas. He's described them in a clear presentation of 84,000 distinct ones. But then as Ling Rinpoche, the young Ling Rinpoche, lately, I've never heard this before, and many people told me they've never heard it before either. The young Ling Rinpoche, traveling around teaching now, he said, these 84,000 are all presented, and Buddha subsumes them all into three. Ignorance, attachment, anger. Cute words, but they have huge meaning. And to understand these three, you will deeply understand Buddha's psychology and your own mind and therefore other people. So these 84,000 all come down to these three in a very logical way. And as Ling Rinpoche said, 21,000 of these are rooted in ignorance. 21,000 have their source in attachment. 21,000 are related to anger. And the final 21,000 are related to all three. Very fast. It's a really intricate, detailed map of the mind, But he narrows it down to these three, and he calls them the three poisons. Well, we could call them, there's a nice term in English, the three toxic emotions. It's very interesting. So, and there's a hierarchical relationship between these, a very intimate relationship. And this is what we learn in high school in depth, In order to understand this first category of states of mind. There's a first category of states of mind of the three, and this lot is all the deluded ones, the rubbish ones. Don't say deluded yet. The nonsense ones, the things they refer to as afflictions. So what is the meaning of the word affliction? It means it's a problem. An affliction is a problem, and it usually is either a physical one or you can have other kinds of problems in your life, Well, at least Geshe Sopa, when he uses the word, Geshe Sopa in his Lam Rim teachings that he taught in Wisconsin, which has been published, and he taught it over 25 years, a commentary on Tsongkhapa, he would always refer to them as mental afflictions. Well, that's getting closer to the truth, because we're discussing the mind here. So these are states of mind that we know, we're familiar with them. We're familiar with anger, depression, jealousy, arrogance, low self-esteem. Maybe we haven't located 84,000. We know the main ones. So they are afflictions, they're problems. But what kind? Mental afflictions. Well, what is another word for an affliction? Maybe the word is illness. Now hear this. In English, this is very shocking, probably in Italian the same. These are mental illnesses. This is probably the most accurate term we could have coming in a meaning of affliction, a mental illness. But of course, in Italian, it's got a powerful meaning, yeah? You get a shock if you hear the mentally ill. You don't admit to it. You're ashamed. You're embarrassed because people over there are mentally ill and I'm normal, right? Is this not how we think? But every one of us knows anxiety, worry, fear, depression, low self-esteem, arrogance. We don't like to admit to that, but we've got it. Anger, attachment. We all know those, but we would never call them mental illnesses unless they're really extreme. Well, Buddha's more radical, He says, sorry, guys, we are all mentally ill. To the degree we have any attachment, any anger, any depression, any low self-esteem, any of these is the degree to which we are mentally ill. And I'm not being sarcastic here. It's still such an uncomfortable concept for us because it's so powerful in our culture. In other words, in our culture, we give equal status, don't we, to love, compassion, kindness, generosity, anger, depression, jealousy, low self-esteem. As long as we have a fairly good balance, we think we're a normal human. This is a really important point to understand. We totally take them as given. This is just a normal person has some anger, some jealousy, some depression. We would never think a person could be rid of all this. This sounds very peculiar. It's shocking to us, in fact. That's why we can't hear what Buddha's saying. That's why we make it called religion, But it's literally what he's saying. He has found from his own experience that all these mental illnesses, these afflictions, these disturbing emotions, these 84,000, not to mention just the three alone, and all the others branch out from these. These are not, he has found this, and this is the key radical point of Buddhism. He has found from his own experience that these are not at the core of our being. They say they're adventitious. Therefore, they can be removed, and that's the entirety of the point of all of Buddha's path from A to Z. So we better understand what he's talking about, if this is the case. And this is not how we talk in our culture. Not how we talk in neuroscience, and not how we talk in psychology. So this first lot, the different terms used, very broadly, they can be called non-virtuous states of mind, negative states of mind. So as soon as we hear negative, we get very embarrassed. I think in modern psychology, it sounds like you're criticizing, and we don't want to do that, you know. We don't like to say that. But there's a very distinct meaning here. Then the second category of states of mind, again, we're so super familiar. Virtues, positive states of mind, useful states of mind, beneficial states of mind. And this is the interesting point we're going to get to, which gets us to this English word delusion, which is a particular way these afflictions function. That, and I'll get to the meaning in a minute. But one of the meanings here is that all of these unhappy states of mind are misconceptions. Which sounds very peculiar. If you see a person raging in anger, and you say they've got a misconception, it sounds just odd. We don't know what, but we have to understand the meaning here. This is the essence of the Buddhist approach to the mind. And when we get this, we can apply it to ourselves, and then we can understand why people suffer. So the key characteristics then of the unhappy states, the word unhappy, afflictions, if you like, call them afflictions. These afflictions, these mental illnesses, is that they're two main characteristics. One is they are deeply, painfully disturbing. Well, that's not rocket science. Check the last time you're anxious. It was awful. Depressed. Awful. Angry. Awful. They're disturbing. It's so clear. That's evident. This other one, not so evident. And this is the meaning of the word delusion. It's, this other one is where, okay. If you've got a 50 euro note and you think it's 500, it's a very simple example. If you've got a 50 euro note but you think it's 500, you'll always be disappointed every time you go to spend it. So you have got a misconception, haven't you? Well, Buddha's saying all these emotional afflictions we've got, these emotions which we've had for a long, long time, which we've practiced for many, many lifetimes, which is why they have such an emotional component, they're all rooted in being misconceptions. Anger is a misconception. Attachment is a misconception. Jealousy is a misconception. When we understand the mental consciousness, the key way our mental consciousness functions in day-to-day life is at the level of conceptuality. That's the level we function at. In Buddhist psychology, we've got these subtler levels, which we only access when we get single-pointed concentration. And that's called perception. It's a very specific definition of that word. But we level at the, Yeah, okay. Yes. When you study the mind and you learn about how the mind functions and about how the mental consciousness functions, it functions in two ways, conceptual and perception. So perception is a common word we all use, but in Buddhist psychology, it's very specifically referring to cognition in concentration meditation, where it's beyond conceptual. We don't have an equivalent of that, so you just have to hear the words, you know. That's direct cognition, unmistaken, not misconceptions. We've got to get that eventually. So the level we function at in day-to-day life, from the time we wake up in the morning until the time we go to sleep, we function at the level of conceptuality. It's very sophisticated the way they present it in Buddhist psychology, but just to hear this now. And so we have lots of conceptions about things, and generally, a correct conception is if, you know, you see 50 euros and you know it's 50 euros. That's a valid conception. If you have 50 euros but think it's 500, that's a misconception. And if you believe it, then clearly you're going to be suffering. You have a lot of emotion around that. Well, that's how Buddha's talking. We've got all these unhappy, neurotic, disturbing states of mind that are rooted in being misconceptions. This is the key way all the first category of states of mind function. And some of them are habitual and have masses of emotion. So anger is one. So, you know, if I need a boyfriend. I've got any boys? There's one. What's your name again? I forget your name. Yes. Who is it?
Piero.
Piero. So Piero's my boyfriend. I'm going to be abusing you all night, Piero. I'm sorry. So let's say Piero's my boyfriend. If I'm in love with, so we're going to go into these later. So let's say I have attachment for Piero. These three. Ignorance, attachment, aversion. I have attachment for Piero. What Buddha means by that is, I'm very needy. I'm not very happy in myself. I completely have all this fantasy. I believe this Piero is going to make me totally happy. I expect that he must make me happy. And he looks the most divine person I've ever seen. In other words, my attachment exaggerates his deliciousness, exaggerates his qualities, exaggerates his capacity to make me happy. It's a lie in many levels. And it's very familiar with all of us. And so it's a misconception. But because it's so ancient in our mind, we don't even think of it as a misconception. We don't even think of it as a conception. It's just a deep habit. So we just, and I totally believe when I've got my attachment glasses on, he will look divine and I will believe in my picture. I will never question it. But we have to get to see, to unpack and unravel our mind. And this is the job of being in high school, as Lama Yeshe calls it, being your own therapist. To start to see how these misconceptions function. I mean, in Mahamudra, this wonderful book of Lama Yeshe's, is it coming into Italian yet? Already come? Oh, wonderful. I'm so happy. I'm so pleased. Okay. So then in there, I identified in the preface, because I edited it, Lama never used the word affliction. Lama was incredible. I think he was born a hippie, honestly. He just knew how to talk to us people. He just knew automatically when he first met us in the 70s, 60s, he just knew no one said affliction. I don't know how he knew. He's never used it. He had 21 different terms. Dualistic puzzle. I mean, I can't even describe this. So gorgeous, you know, in his effort to get us to understand how these states of mind function, which is the key to being a Buddhist, you know. So delusion in English is a brilliant word. If you're considered delusional in psychology, it's a term they use, you're believing in something that isn't true. So you're believing in 500 euros, it's not true. So you're delusional. Well, attachment believes more than there really is there. It's putting a whole pile of things onto Piero that aren't existing. As Lama Zopa says, delusions, mental afflictions, mental illnesses, these dualistic puzzles, whatever word you like, what they do is they decorate on top of what is there, layers upon layers upon layers of characteristics that are not there. We live like this, and this is why we suffer, Buddha says. But we don't recognize, and that's our job, to recognize, to unpack and unravel these. So they're the afflictions. But delusion in English is perfect word. Perfect word. You're believing in something that doesn't exist. This is the key function of all these 84,000 load of rubbish, you know. The second category, it's dinner time, I have to go. The second category are not delusional, not afflictions, not misconceptions. They are valid cognitions, and they are love, kindness, generosity, forgiveness, intelligence, etc. They're valid. So the Buddha says we can grow those to perfection and we can get rid of all the rubbish. It's an outrageous concept, but that's what he's saying, you know. So this is fundamental to being a Buddhist, is to understand this, because this is a job to be done. And when I can do this job and I understand my mind and know this is why I'm suffering, now I can have compassion for others. And who would I have compassion for? For the pedophiles, for the wackos, for the ex-husband, for the crazies. Right now we think they're maniacs and we want them to go to hell. But when we understand the mind, we'll know why they are suffering. And when we understand karma, we know why they're doing it. So karma and delusions is junior school and high school. It's the essence of why we suffer. It's the essence of Buddha's entire view of the universe. And we need to understand these nuts and bolts in the first stages of practice in relation to ourself. Then we're qualified. Oh, my God, we're all in the same boat. We will see, you know. So we're going to go into all of this the next few days. Okay? No time for questions. We've got another session tonight, haven't we? Oh, we can carry on. Good, okay. So one way Buddha's saying is to see everything differently. Okay? So right now we have lots of attachment for our food usually. You mean most of us do. Which means we're seeing things in the food that don't exist there. So let's see the food differently. Let's see it in terms of kindness, the people who made it, the people who cut it, the people who drove it, all the creatures who died on the road, you know, got slammed into the windsill, and you know, all the creatures who died. Maybe it's vegetarian, but don't think creatures haven't died for our dinner. The people who sold it, the people who picked it, the creature, all the billions of creatures who died when they grew it. We think of all of this, and we think we're going to eat this food so we can be fat and healthy, so we can continue to work on our mind, develop our marvelous potential, and be of benefit and repay the kindness of all these sentient beings. So think like that for your dinner. Okay? So we just dedicate this little hour we've had, or however long we've been here. No, it's too soon. What time's dinner? Oh, now the whole 30 minutes. Oh, you've got time for questions. Sorry, I thought it was time to go. Oh, good. Questions, come on. Questions. We've got hours to go. We can finish the entire path before we go to dinner. Questions? Come on. What? What's happened? Oh, the noise. What? Fast. But I have talking half the pace of normal, consciously. But you will, but listen, honey, have you, but listen, wait. Have you heard all this before? Has she heard it before? Yes or no? And then? So what are you trying to listen to, English or Spanish? English or Italian? So maybe you're just used to me in English. We'll get to, you can get used to me in Italian. It's okay. Okay, I will do my best, but I promise you, suddenly you'll find you'll be able to understand. I promise. What'd she say? Yeah. But you've been hearing me in English before, but you understood me. Oh, I see. So you don't want to do it that way. You don't want to, but you see, you don't want to do it that way, do you? You prefer simultaneous. I know you do. Any opinions in the room? I don't want to fight with anybody. Does anybody prefer simultaneous or me speak and then give it a break? What do you prefer? What? What's it, simultaneous?
Simultaneous is raising up the hand.
Okay, so consecutive? Who wants it the other way? You did. Put your hand up. One person.
I also imagine that it might be more beneficial consecutive because for me the speed is perfect and I understand everything perfectly. It's also because I'm a native English speaker.
Oh, I see. So is it... Okay. But I am, I've already half the pace, Siliana.
Scusate un attimo. Robina è molto veloce nel parlare, ok? Quindi, piano piano, vi abituerete alla sua velocità e quindi è semplicemente un modo di imparare a pensare veloci. Okay.
Uh-huh. Is everybody else, is anybody else having a problem?
No?
Why don't we just, listen, why don't we experiment with just for 5 minutes? I say a bit, you say it after. Just try. See how it goes. No, you don't want to do it. Okay. Any questions? Okay, we'll see. We'll be right. We'll find a way. I found other people, because I'm so shocking when I talk, I know that, and I say things in a different way, kind of weird, so it's a bit shocking to get used to it. But I found many people say, and after a while, I just got used to you. I understood. So give it a day. All right? See? You. What's your name? Frita?
Paola.
Okay, darling. So meanwhile, let's see if we can ask some questions. Questions? Any questions?
Okay. In a recent talk that I listened to a few days ago by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he mentioned a few concepts taken from the Abhidharma Kosha. About this concept, he said that. Some of them have to be taken in relation to what modern science has discovered.
I understand that. That would make sense, yeah.
Obviously,
yes.
They are not consistent with what modern science has discovered. And
yeah, I understand. But that's not relevant to today. Okay. All this, yeah, I understand. Sure, I understand. Yep, so question? I know, but I don't think this is a problem. His Holiness is talking to the world of people who have materialist philosophical views, right? Philosophical materialists, aren't they? Isn't it? Then their view is just this planet. Well, you know perfectly well that Dalai Lama, when he's teaching to Tibetans and to Buddhists, he talks about the hell realms. He's not discussing hell realms to these materialists. Science does not prove there are hell realms and not hell realms. So you've got to take the context. He's talking just the physical world that we can see with our eyes. There's no contradiction. Isn't it? Do you see? There's context. Isn't it? Do you understand? Don't you agree? But isn't that the answer for you?
No, well, on the other hand, it looks to me that there are some concepts which have to be taken not at face value.
But he's talking to scientists. He's talking to materialists. Are you a Buddhist? I'm just asking, not being rude. So you take a view of hell realms and things. You accept that view. Well, in the same way that you want to take things at face value, just give yourself time. If you get to getting single point of concentration, then you will see yourself if it's true. So take it as your hypothesis and relax about it. I don't think it's a problem. It's either true or it's not. If something is either true or it's not. There's only two options, isn't it? And we have to find out, don't we? So take it as your hypothesis and leave it there, one step at a time. I mean, I hear all those things. I couldn't care less about Mount Meru. I figure when I'm clairvoyant, I will see. And I'm not worried about it. But if I'm sitting teaching a neuroscientific class, I would talk differently, obviously. Don't you agree? Yeah. Who else? Something else? Nothing else. No questions. Yep.
What's the Mahamudra actually?
Mahamudra. Okay. 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 So Mahamudra is this term in Sanskrit, great seal, that's been kind of cultivated over the centuries. I don't know where it started, but certainly the text on those teachings that we use is by the first Panchen Lama in the, I think, 17th century or something. And we're referring specifically here to a commentary by Lama Yeshe. And all it is a synonym, an equivalent for the word emptiness. It's just a term that's been cultivated because everything's being empty is what seals everything as existing. So it's called the Great Seal. It's just a synonym. But it's referring to the Mahamudra teachings, just the classic presentation of the two modes of meditation, single-pointed concentration, and then using that, the second mode of meditation, to get insight into emptiness, That's it. That's what it's referring to.
And what's the second mode?
It's called insight meditation. And we'll discuss all these. Yeah? Okay. Someone else? Nothing else? No questions? Yes.
What if you go to college, I mean, to the compassion wing, skipping the high...
You can't. You can't. You won't. You won't be able to. You're not qualified. You can't go to university level science if you haven't done junior school and high school. If you can go to university when you're age 11, that implies you've already done junior school and high school very quickly. It's knowledge. You can't miss the first stages of the ladder. You've got to go through them. You know, if you come into this life like Kundrala, Rinpoche's disciple, but also his guru, she came fully developed into this world. She's done it all before. You can't possibly skip the knowledge. It's not possible. Do you hear me? It's not logical. Because if you want to develop compassion for all sentient beings, that includes the pedophiles, the harmers. There's no view in our ordinary world for having any compassion for pedophiles and torturers and maniacs and warmongers. We just think they're evil and should be, you know, sent to hell. There's no way we have a view in materialist view to have compassion for them. So you only know the reason why to have compassion for them when you learn high school and you learn the Four Noble Truths, and junior school when you learn about the mind and karma. That's where you get to learn the nuts and bolts of why you suffer and therefore why you cause suffering and therefore why others suffer and why they cause suffering. It explains the whole of samsara. Do you understand? You have to know that. Yeah. What else, people? All right, seeing as we've got 10 more minutes or something, let's talk more then about... Well, now we're in high school, let's talk about the mind more. Okay, so all these trillions of thoughts, feelings, emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, this entire spectrum of our inner being. For the Buddha, this is our mind. And so let's look at what he also says about the mind, because this is too fundamentally different from the way we describe in the philosophical view and indeed in the Christian views and all the others. So Buddha asserts only mind and body. We don't need a third component. So, and they are distinctly different phenomena. So, for the Buddha, the word mind is used virtually synonymously with the word consciousness, used in different contexts, but they're referring to the same thing. First. Second, the word mind or consciousness is referring to all these contents. Thoughts, feelings, emotions, unconscious, subconscious, but also to eye consciousness, ear consciousness, etc. All of this then, all of mind, fundamental point in Buddhism, the whole of Buddhism would collapse into a heap of total absurdity if this can be proved not to be true. Mind is not physical. This is crystal clear for the Buddha. And this is clearly something we have to take as a hypothesis. Because this argues completely, fundamentally, with the entire philosophical materialist view that's expressed in modern science, that the mind is equivalent to the brain. But this is where now it's so marvelous, this last 30, 40 years, and these conversations between His Holiness and all the Tibetan Buddhist scholars, as with all the great brains of our culture. This is where it's been incredible. He's brought major shifts in their thinking, you know. They've got incredible respect now for Buddhism and indeed all the ancient Indian history, all the Indian knowledge before. Whereas these, you know, normally in our world, what do we know? Nothing. We know nothing about Asia, nothing about India, nothing about Africa. We just go back to the Greeks, don't we? You know, we Europeans. We think they're the fancy people. You know, so it's really amazing what he's been doing this last 30, 40 years. And now people fundamentally questioning these assumptions about the nature of mind. I mean, when I was working on Lama Zopa Rinpoche's book about how to help at the time of death, I was reading a book, because I edited that too. I was reading a book by an American medical journalist who was writing about all the problems and contradictions now, certainly in the American states, in the medical profession, because the book was about the whole business of, you know, cutting, giving organs to people. And so he said there's so many problems and contradictions coming now in this industry because people are now really questioning what the mind is. When does life end? Because it's really bringing so much conflict. And this is excellent because people are now questioning their assumptions. So many instances. I know we know in all cultures there are so many experiences reported of people coming back to life. Of course, in science, we just think it's a joke. We don't know how to explain it. But now, because you're taking people's organs out and they look like they're dead and they come back to life again, we're really confused about what life is and what death is. And this is fantastic. I remember one doctor in this industry saying, I can now say with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I don't know what it is, but that much I can say. And all these amazing scientists who really revere His Holiness doing incredible research now into this possibility that there is more to consciousness than the brain, which is amazing. It's marvelous. But this is what Buddha's been saying for 2,500 years. It's what these Indians found more than 3,000 years ago. So this knowledge has been around, but it's not in our modern European culture. That's all. So fundamental for the Buddha, the whole load of rubbish. If we can prove that mind is not, if we can prove that mind is physical. So for him, it's not physical. First point. Second, like I said, it's a word that's referred to this entire contents. Third, as I've already indicated, from the great Indian yogis before the Buddha, the Buddhists, discovering these subtler levels of consciousness that we only can access when we've got this single-pointed concentration, shamatha. Of course, this is abstract in our modern culture because that level of mind doesn't need a brain. Clearly, at the gross level, we do have a body, we have a brain, this is obvious. But the Buddha's approach is it works intimately and inextricably with consciousness. But at a subtle level of mind, when you've got shamatha, there's no evidence of a brain because you've accessed a subtler level of cognition. And that level of cognition has the capacity to cognize phenomena that the gross level can't, like the past, the future. This is completely part of the whole Buddhist view. So your mind is not physical. It's got these far more subtle levels. It's got all this entire spectrum of your inner being. There's no part of you called a soul or a spirit. But the other one that's really radical and quite shocking, that disagrees both with all the religious views and the materialist views, your mind is not given to you by anybody else. This is the weirdest idea for the Buddha, I tell you. No one can give you anger, give you love, give you being good at music or good at football. No one can give you psychosis or happiness. It's a bizarre idea for the Buddha. This is the most shocking because if we're materialists, we absolutely believe without question that mummy and daddy made me, gave me love, gave me psychosis, gave me depression. That's the logic we use in our culture. That's where we look. We look back in the past. Where did it come from? We go back to mummy, daddy, grandma, grandpa, and back to the monkeys. That's our analysis, isn't it? That's not the Buddha's. So, nor also Buddha disagrees with the Christian view, the Muslim view, that God gave, there's no creator in Buddhism. He's not being rude. We don't need creating. We do fine creating ourselves, you know. That's the Buddha's view. That's a weird idea as well. That is a very different view in Buddhism, you know. So what's Buddha's view? Where did I begin? If I didn't begin in mummy and daddy, if I didn't begin in God, where did I begin? Well, you began, the first moment of you. If we track our mind back, one of the terms they use in Buddhist psychology is mental continuum. Well, think of your mind like a river of mental moments. This moment of thoughts and feelings and emotions having their source in the previous moment of thoughts, feelings and emotions. Those thoughts, feelings and emotions having their source in the previous moment. And you can track your mind back if you had perfect memory in an unbroken chain of mental moments, couldn't you? And you'd keep tracking it back in an unbroken chain. There'd never be a piece missing until you get back inevitably, inexorably to the first second of conception. So then what? Well, the second before conception, egg was in mummy's body, sperm was in daddy's body. Nothing to do with the creator. And your consciousness had its own continuity going back a moment before that. More subtle, obviously. And a moment before that. And then a few weeks before that, your mind was in another body. And so on and so forth. Back and back and back. This is Buddha's view. This is Buddha's findings. So many people who are Buddhist, you know, don't even think about karma. Don't even think about reincarnation. And no one says you have to. You're the boss. But if you want the big picture in Buddhism, if you want the whole big picture, this is how he talks, you know. So we'll go into all this as we go along. And all this has a major role in many ways. And it does have a role in understanding the whole big picture that then informs our capacity to understand those more advanced practices, which we will talk about. So that's your mind. A beginningless continuity of mental moments, by definition not physical, but inextricably linked to the physical. You know, this intimate relationship. It's very clear. So the key experiential implication of this idea, that if your mind tracks its back to the continuity of this same river of mental moments, the implication of this is, then what's in your mind is put there beforehand by you. The idea that someone else can give you anger is really quite schizophrenic for the Buddha. He doesn't say it that way. But it's weird, plain ridiculous. But that's what we believe in the West. That's why we blame our mums. We never blame our father. They have equal role, don't they? But we always blame our mums. And if you're Italian, I've heard you blame God. I remember Lama Yeshe, I heard, when he was in the hospital seeing Geshe Gampa Gyatso one time. He was in hospital years ago, obviously years ago. And all the boys in the ward and all the Italian boys were translating to Lama all the rude things the Italian men were saying about God. You know, Lama was very shocked, like God is a pig. But I've heard there's even worse words for Our Lady, aren't there? She's a whore, isn't she? But some Argentinian told me that they're even worse than the Italians. Anyway, I was a Catholic. We never said a word bad about God. My father wasn't Catholic, and he would say very rude things. We'd wait for God to come through the ceiling. We were so shocked, you know. We were never rude about God. Anyway, you can't blame God. So in Buddhism, there's no one to blame. It's just accountability, you know. You bring your own stuff with you. This itself is a really profound concept, and this is the basis of really sound Buddhist practice. We are accountable. We become responsible. And it lessens attachment. It lessens anger. It lessens blame. It lessens guilt. It's huge, powerful concept. But you've got to internalize it, you know. So we'll discuss all this. And this, again, this view of karma has a major role in our ability to do these practices called transforming problems into happiness. So now you can have dinner. Was that better? See, she's already used to me. Okay. Okay. So we're going to have fun the next few days. We've got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Oh, my gosh. I hope you don't get exhausted. Okay. So Lama Zopa says, we did our little blessing before for our dinner, right? We did the blessing. It didn't sound like a blessing, but it was a blessing. Thinking about seeing lunch different, seeing dinner differently. But because every thought counts, for the Buddha, no thoughts go astray. Everything stays. So just thinking for 30 seconds like we did before about our dinner in a different way, not, as opposed to attachment's way, this is so powerful. We changed the very action of eating dinner, you know. We made it more beneficial. We'll discuss all this later. So then you enjoy your dinner and come back and I'll see you at 8:30. Yeah, okay. There's no mention. Was there mention of silence? Were we doing anything like silence or something? I don't know. What was the plan? Silence doesn't come into it? I'm not asking for it. I'm just curious. Did that come into the discussion?
They didn't talk about silence.
Okay. Well, then forget silence. But I'll tell you what, a far more difficult discipline than silence is to speak usefully. In other words, if you're going to talk, don't be sort of serious. You can talk about the weather. You can tell people who you are. But don't just rabbit on about nothing. It's a really good discipline. Discuss this. It makes it much more exciting, you know, discuss what we just talked about. Then it makes speech useful, you know. This is where we start to look into junior school, abiding by the laws of karma. We'll go into that. So make, you know, And if you don't want to talk, then good, be silent. No one's forcing you to talk. That's a really good practice as well. So usefully talk or shut up. Okay? It's a good discipline. I'll see you at 8:30. Thank you.